I think the Suns have got to be in the mix. When you look at teams who haven't made the playoffs since 2011, and then you look at the sheer diversity of their mistakes, like basically anything you could do wrong as a front office, they've done, whether it's, you know, angering players, chasing superstars in free agency that they had no shot at getting, overpaying veterans. I mean, just the list goes on and on.
Got a real treat for you once again. It's Ben Golliver joining me to talk hoops. Ben, thanks for coming on.
Oh, my pleasure, man. How's it going?
It's going pretty well. I'm looking forward to doing some gossip about the teams that are being drama queens around the NBA. We've talked a little bit about this on Twitter, and you've written a lot about this and talked about it on your show. You can find Ben over at si.com, and you can listen to him on the Open Court. And yeah, it's going to be good. Were you one of the cookie types, like in high school, you know?
I don't know about all that. I played soccer. I was kind of a nerd, you know. I was hitting the books pretty hard. So I don't think I was... I don't have a long track record in drama, if that's what you're trying to get at.
Oh, well, you know, that's too bad. I was just like that. I was always spreading rumors about Becky and her boyfriend making out behind the bleachers. But this time, we're going to be talking about NBA teams. So I wanted to start with the 76ers. And I told you that we wanted to be the adult in the room. And the reason I thought about that specifically is because I was listening to the Rice to Ricky Sanchez the other day. And their guest was describing Colangelo during a press conference going up and saying, "I know everyone's waiting for me to make the wrong move," and just being really neurotic. And I was thinking about it a little bit more, and that is a really weird, neurotic thing to say for an NBA GM. So do you think that, first of all, do you think that he can be the adult in the room? Or do you think that, I mean, I'm trying to imply that I still think Nerlens and Jahlil should be moved at the trade deadline.
Yeah. Well, we have had the rumors out there about Jahlil, and I think if you're a Sixers fan, that should be kind of promising on two fronts, right? I mean, number one, the adult front, like you're mentioning, which is, you know, does he have the test, the fortitude, however you want to phrase that. Does he have the fortitude to trade a guy who was part of supposedly their building core and drafted by a very popular, albeit polarizing, former GM? It seems like he does. I mean, otherwise it wouldn't get out, and it would get pushed back on a lot harder than it did. And I think it's also promising for Sixers fans, because if you can get a first round pick for Jahlil Okafor, you got to do it. I mean, it kind of reminds me a little bit of the Thomas Robinson situation. Remember that a few years ago?
Yeah.
Sacramento trade out of him very quickly. Then Houston traded out of him very quickly. And every time he got traded, there was this big like pushback online of like, "Oh my gosh, like you can get this guy for a first round pick." And it's like, well, yeah, I mean, there's a reason why he's being made available. Like, he's not that good. And I think Okafor has certainly more polished and refined skills than a guy like Thomas Robinson offensively, but he's just really hard to keep on the court, especially in any sort of a starting configuration. And if you're Philadelphia and you do have this need to kind of turn the page and get on with the future, and you do, still lack talent, frankly, and you're looking at a situation where Okafor and Embiid can't really play together, it makes all the sense in the world for him to be the first guy to go. And so I think if I'm a Sixers fan, I was cheering the trade news for multiple reasons there.
So when you say the trade news, I assume that you're talking about Chicago and then the Pelicans expressing interest.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Pelicans thing, it sounded like that was like a fairly firm offer, especially this early on. And usually if you're, 2 weeks out of the trade deadline, you're getting to kind of specific terms of structures. And like I said, there's not this crazy like, "Oh, let's dump cold water on it," and immediately pushback. Then you got to realize something's there. And it makes all the sense for Okafor to want to get traded, too. I mean, if you're him, what good is it to be on Philadelphia's bench and kind of having a question mark to your role going forward when you're young and you're trying to maximize your earning potential? It doesn't make any sense at all. And, I've even kind of joked on the Open Floor podcast, like, it doesn't even seem like he's part of the team. Like, even when they were winning and TJ McConnell is doing all these crazy celebrations. Like Okafor is kind of on the sideline, not even really part of it, even for the fun times. And, you know, little things like that, you know, they do add up. And he has every reason not to think he's part of their central, you know, push going forward. I mean, it seems like it's Embiid's team. It's going to be Simmons's team. He doesn't fit. And the earlier he can get out from that, the better, I think. And he shouldn't look back.
You know, as you were saying that, I was thinking about Nerlens Noel being in a really similar situation. It initially looked like Nerlens was going to be the guy on the outside looking in. That's so weird how I feel like Joel Embiid, or just maybe the superstar of a team, can just sort of like put your hand on someone and they're anointed, and all of a sudden they're popping up in Instagram photos and they're happy on the bench and involved with the team, and then, you know, maybe you fall out of favor and you move back over to Nerlens, and now he's actually getting minutes and he's the guy who is going to be, you know, the second big next to Joel Embiid. Is that it? Like, or is it just like, I'm getting minutes and I'm happy now? Because it seems like their mood just sort of traded places based on, you know, minutes and then fit.
Yeah, I think it all comes down to fit. I mean, Nerlens to me makes more sense with Embiid because, you know, he's just sort of, you know, another defensive cog, right? And for Okafor, like, it's not just that he needs lots of minutes to kind of get comfortable, but he completely changes how an offense is shaped around him. I mean, he leaves a huge impact. A guy like Noel leaves no impact offensively, right? So I still think you could be in situations where you're running a lot of your offense through Embiid, and Noel is just sort of, you know, kind of a weak side garbage guy, and now all of a sudden you're able to kind of pair their defensive talents together. Like, I think that could potentially work if they can get them both on the court together at the same time. I just never see how that pairing is going to work with Okafor. And, you know, I dug this up a little bit ago. You know, they've only played 80 minutes together this season, Okafor and Embiid. And, like, the on-off numbers are just atrocious. And yeah, we know anytime Embiid's been on the court this year for Philadelphia, they've been really, really strong. Like, he improves their defense from, like, 25th to 1st when he steps on the court. So the fact that he has such a strong negative rating when he's playing with Okafor just is a huge red flag, because he's been a real positive impact kind of guy. So when you're building your future and you're trying to pick two out of these three, it's pretty easy to make the case for Noel. And the question mark with him, though, is can you keep him happy financially? You know, because you've basically blown, you know, multiple years of his life going through the process. And can you keep him in, you know, believing that he can still earn a really quality second contract, which is very important for any player, obviously. And then also, can you keep him engaged through the losing? And I think Embiid really helps with that second part. And then also, they have all the money in the world in Philadelphia, and if Embiid wants him around, then you can go ahead and afford to pay him, and it's not going to be a problem. I mean, just keep him on the roster there, and no big deal. So if I'm Philadelphia, and it is time to start moving forward, like you mentioned, you know, taking the adult approach of what's our next era going to be, I think the smartest first step is to just move Okafor out, and then the next step is take care of Noel this summer financially, and then hopefully the Ben Simmons hype train will come out, you know, right after the All-Star weekend, and that'll carry you through the rest of the regular season.
Hey, I believe. So, moving along to the New Orleans Pelicans, because that's the one that you said that you were specifically talking about. I think, you know, what they're hoping is what Colangelo is afraid of, that, you know, this guy who was picked by Hinkie, you know, allegedly maybe the ownership picked Jahlil, who knows? I think some people know. they're afraid that, you know, or Colangelo's afraid that the narrative after all of this goes down is that, man, Hinkie was so great, and he picked this Jahlil guy who ended up being the next Tim Duncan, and that's what he's afraid of, and that's what the Pelicans want. Are the Pelicans, you know, maybe being a little bit too optimistic? Do they sort of need an adult in the room to be like, you know, wait, hold on a minute. Are we sure that we want to cough up this much for a guy in Jahlil that might not even be a good fit next to our superstar?
Yeah, so a couple of things. I'll get back to Colangelo for a second, but the Pelicans don't just need an adult in the room. They need a whole new room. They need a whole new building. Okay, I mean, the situation that they found themselves in is just utter desperation, because it's always tried to be you know, these questionable decisions of, oh, maybe this will be something that will help Anthony. Maybe this will help Anthony. Maybe this will help Anthony. And they've just all backfired one after another. A lot of talent has bled out of that situation in free agency. You know, you look at guys like Eric Gordon and Ryan Anderson leaving basically for nothing. And then they've also had a lot of guys where they've paid money and then really not gotten it a good return on their investment, in part because, you know, questions about their medical staff. You know, you look at guys like, you know, Tyreek Evans, Drew Holiday. I mean, even Gordon and Anderson back when they were there. I mean, these guys are just not staying on the court at the kind of rates that you would expect for guys who aren't, you know, 35 years old. I mean, so, you know, if they do trade for Okafor, that would be the type of move where, again, you're trying to placate your best player and trying to give him cause for hope and trying to kind of push them over to the top. And, you know, we see these kinds of trades sometimes in the NBA. Like, great example, last year, you know, Washington cashes in a first-round pick to get Markieff Morris. You know, they were kind of at a disappointing point in their season when they did that. They were also trying to kind of save things. But you could at least see the ceiling with their core group. Like, in a best-case scenario, Washington is this team that can make this, you know, kind of dark horse run at the Eastern Conference Finals. And that's kind of how it's starting to play out this season a little bit. I don't see the ceiling at all with New Orleans' group. And so then you start to wonder, why are you trading for now if now isn't going to be that great? If now is just barely scraping to the eighth seed, is that really the best use of your assets? I don't know. In terms of Colangelo, you know, this is a guy who has a long track record in basketball. He's won awards as an executive. So he is a little bit of an easy punching bag right now, especially because, you know, Philadelphia fans are rightfully, I think, you know, probably still feeling burned by the way the transition went down, how suddenly it went down. I think ultimately he realizes that time is on his side, right? Like, he could rush into a mistake and that would be a mistake itself. Like, you could still do some of these Okafor trades. You could still wait on Simmons. You can still do a lot of the other things that they want to do. And there's no huge rush because the main guys in that roster are so young. So I do think at least some of what he's doing is sort of calculated in terms of, you know, PR management. You know, if he had gone in there on day one and completely shredded the place, that would have been tough to sustain. But the more time passes, I think the more leeway he's going to have.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see on that end. But I definitely agree with you on the side of the Pelicans, though. You know, Quincy Pondexter even was a guy who I was really excited about. But their medical staff just, you know, like, couldn't keep him on the floor. Don't you think it's a really odd place for Donatas Moniunis to have ended up? Like, in that context, right?
Well, they love the Houston Castoffs. That's definitely
No, but I mean, like, their medical staff has this terrible reputation. His back, like, that just seems like, is his agent still his agent? Because, like, that was just...
Yeah, you're basically picturing a guy being wrapped together with duct tape and put out there next to Anthony Davis. Yeah, no, I hear you. That was a really complicated scenario, far more complicated than it needed to be. You know, I love sometimes how the people who are way into this stuff want to know every, like, blow by blow of these negotiations. And I'm curious too, but at the end of the day, this guy hasn't done anything in the NBA. Like, why are we so excited about it? Let's talk about Terrence Jones, you know, another one of these Houston castoffs who's actually played, you know, fairly well for the Pelicans and has certainly kind of outperformed his minimum deal. But, you know, I look at New Orleans and it starts with the owner. You know, does he even care? I think that's a huge question. And and that's part of the reason why I feel bad for Anthony Davis, because, you know, you might be in a bad situation. There's guys who are stuck right now, you know, even
and
a guy
who,
like,
even is the owner, right? Like, their ownership situation is, like, up in the air. Like, it might be, like, an 83-year-old. It might be his ex-wife, and it might be the kids, right?
Yeah, you never want the team in, like, a divorce proceeding. That's always a bad scenario, right? And so, you know, it starts there, and that just kind of underlines for Davis what the challenge is, because he's not just trying to change a roster. You know, he's trying to change an entire organization, entire structure. So I actually expect that to be a pretty big storyline here during All-Star Weekend. I think the Anthony Davis sympathy stuff is going to come out in full force, because – New Orleans is one of those teams that tends to just kind of get overlooked and ignored, you know, throw them in the same category with, like, Orlando and Phoenix, of just teams that don't really get talked about a lot. There's not going to be any avoiding them when the entire basketball media world is down there in New Orleans for All-Star Weekend. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if we start hearing, you know, more talk about, oh, free Anthony, or how can, you know, isn't it time to kind of overhaul that front office? What are they going to do at the trade deadline? I think they're going to be a major flashpoint.
Yeah, I mean, I think they definitely need an adult in the room, and probably the free Anthony stuff is going to start happening. Again, Ben writes over at Sports Illustrated. We talked earlier in the season about an article he wrote called Stranded Superstars, and Anthony Davis, I think maybe trading for Jahlil, it's okay insofar as it has some upside, maybe not as much upside as that first round pick might. But it seems like he's going to continue to be stranded, which is really concerning. Another stranded superstar on another team that probably needs an adult in the room. And this is almost like more literal, based on some of the reports that are coming out of Chicago. I know that there are definitely teams that think this way, and that do stuff like the whole, well, Jimmy, if you don't take our offer, then we're just going to play Tony Snell over you. I know that like teams think that way, but the fact that they actually communicated that to Jimmy is really odd to me. Is that like a thing that happened? Should I not be as surprised?
One of these things is, you know, usually after the fact, it kind of comes out in very, you know, blunt terms. And maybe that communication didn't quite happen in that manner. I don't know. I wasn't on those phone calls, but those kinds of messages can come in hard, direct manner, and also in kind of soft manners too, right? Like, that's part of a negotiation, is you're trying to, you know, maybe if you're the Bulls, you're thinking, well, we do have a bunch of young wings here. It's not like this is going to be Jimmy's team. And at that point, it certainly wasn't. I mean, when they were doing that original negotiation, it was still kind of, everything was viewed through that lens of Derrick Rose, right? And so, you know, maybe it's like, well, look, you know, we're going to probably have to try to hedge our bets a little bit and play everybody. I mean, you know, that could be like a reasonable version of that message to Jimmy, basically saying like, look, you know, you're not going to have 40 minutes and all the touches that you want, because we've got to, you know, look at some of these other guys. Whereas 2 years later, maybe it comes out in kind of a different light as like a threat, right? So I wasn't there. I don't know how it came out, but there's all sorts of different ways where kind of the same basic message could get communicated, but then, you know, through the game of telephone, it becomes something else. What I do know though, is during that negotiation, he was, you know, or his side rather, I guess is probably the right way to put it, was surprised at the number that was being offered. You know, I wouldn't necessarily say offended, but like, why are they not seeing what they have here? And you remember the big push about how Jimmy was going to bet on himself. I think Walsh had that as the headline right afterwards. He felt that very strongly and very deeply, right? Like during that negotiation was like, look, I value myself and my ability a lot higher than they did during this negotiation, and I'm going to prove it to them. And you don't get that kind of a disconnect that often. I mean, think about some of these early extensions we saw last year. Giannis, Victor Oladipo, Zeller, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist. I mean, usually these guys, you know, and even some of those guys who were sort of limited players a la, you know, Kidd-Gilchrist, usually that their self-perception or their side's perception of what a fair number is pretty close. In Jimmy's case, it wound up being the offer was like roughly half of what he wound up signing for, maybe even a little less.
So how low are we talking? Like 8 or something, or 6?
Yeah, I think the total value on the 4-year deal was something like in the $40 million range, and he wound up signing for what, like 80 plus?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a big span, right? And again, it's almost like, imagine if your boss offered you half of what you thought you were worth, you know, or what the market would eventually deem you what you're worth. Like, are you just going to forget that? You know, I mean, and that's probably going to always be in your head a little bit. And part of the transition too was that, again, Chicago's offer was that because they didn't view him as the main guy. It was still this Rose thing, right? And eventually it played out. And to me, they should have had the foresight, especially when Jimmy really broke out early in that season. They should have had the foresight to shift gears quickly from Rose to Butler and start building everything around Butler. And that was sort of their critical error. They really dragged their feet on trying to make it work with Derrick Rose. He's the local kid. They invested all this money in him. He was so popular. They had a really hard time getting away from that. And then once they finally did, they basically just made up their entire plan for the summer on the fly. It wasn't really a well-constructed or carefully conceived plan, and it wasn't designed around Butler. And so what you're left with is an incredibly inconsistent team that, you know, kind of looks, frankly, pretty awful a lot of the times when he's not on the court, and has its moments, too. You know, I mean, when Wade's rolling and Butler's happy and everybody else is kind of fitting in, it's a kind of an interesting and a little bit scary team, and they had some good times early in the season. But when things aren't going right, as we've seen in some of these locker room blowups and the back and forth, they can get really ugly. And I think some of the ugliness you've seen, I think, you know, maybe Jimmy's comments in terms of, you know, talking down to his teammates and so forth, I always kind of interpreted that as being, you know, kind of displaced frustration. You know, there's other people in the organization, in the overall framework, who have probably have greater cause to have frustrated him. And maybe in those situations after a tough loss, you know, he took it out on some younger guys who weren't the actual cause of the frustration.
Yeah, that's sort of what I was thinking, is that it just sounds like at this point such a toxic situation that, you know, maybe like a different person in a different situation should be expected to be happy and not lash out at, what, like Fitzer? Is that guy's name? But, you know, especially after the whole, you know, contract issue and the whole breakdown of that and the perceived threats, at least, at the very least, maybe real threats, it's hard for me to think that Jimmy Butler is ever going to be, have a home in Chicago. Is that what you think?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, we should all be very wary of the James Harden turnaround in Houston, right? And I think it's a great example and a great case study, because you look at what they did last summer, they had a choice. You know, Harden was in the middle of all these locker room issues, didn't get along with Dwight Howard. They realized they were probably going to have to pick one or the other. It was a pretty easy pick based on Harden's age and ability. He was the better player. And so instead of just trying to kind of do that, you know, half stepping, you know, just be like, oh, okay, we're going to try to, you know, build around Harden. What Houston really did was they like triple downed on him, right? I mean, they gave him an extension to give him even more money than he was already making. You know, he was basically at a max. They raised that. They got multiple guys who were going to make his life easier in terms of shooters. They basically sacrificed any of the stress of playing defense by, you know, going into this crazy new offense approach that basically no one's ever seen in terms of how many threes they're going to take. And they brought in a coach that completely empowered him, right? So if they were going to go down this year, they were going to go down because of Harden, and Harden was going to take all the blame for it, right? A lot of times, these A-list guys love that responsibility, right? They love being the guy, and it's worked. I mean, Harden has risen to the occasion. He's shown that he can be responsible and carry a team, and so far, so good. You know, there are ways that it could get screwed up, but so far, it's been one of the NBA's big success stories. That's exactly the opposite of what they've done in Chicago with Jimmy, in terms of finding pieces that don't really make sense, finding a coach whose personality is clearly not getting along with Jimmy and other guys, you know, key players on that team, and then just having no real rhyme or reason to their roster building from a big picture perspective, and to have all this old baggage from the front office. I think you're right. I mean, you tell me, is this a situation that can be turned around like Houston turned it around? Like, can they clean house, trade a few people, hire a new coach, get a couple shooters, and call this good? I don't know if it's going to be that easy in Chicago.
Yeah, and you know, I think that was a really interesting response, because if the management was more fluid, and if GarPax wasn't such an institutionalized thing or institutional thing, then maybe it could. You know, I mean, if this summer, when they had said, okay, we're going to break down and move on from these guys, get younger and build around Butler, and they had actually meant it, then this year would have looked a lot different. Just out of curiosity, and this is a little bit off topic, how would you do that? How would you build a team around Jimmy Butler? Would that just be, I feel like you couldn't go full Harden, like just put up threes. You probably need a little bit more of like a half court thing, maybe more defense, because you just would need a defensive-minded coach. I mean, what would you think? How would Chicago do that? How would Chicago, either this offseason or at the trade deadline, make the moves and make the hirings that they would need to sort of rectify the situation.
Yeah, I mean, you always start with your best player's best skills, right? And so I think in terms of Jimmy's best skills, it's really pounding from the wing in sort of like a DeMar DeRozan-like fashion on offense, getting to the free throw line, bullying people. You know, he's got a little playmaking for others in him. I don't think he's capable of being like a full-time point guard, but you know, in their current situation right now, I'd be giving him as many of those reps as possible because their other point guard options are pretty bad. I'm actually intrigued by the fit in Boston, you know, as a potential trade place. And some of the things that Boston has in terms of, you know, pit bull perimeter defenders, you know, that kind of gives you an identity that could really, you know, be something, you know. And I think that Jimmy would be at home in a defense first environment where everyone is just a dog and they all work hard and they're, up in people's, you know, handles, you know, for, you know, three quarter court pressing and all that stuff. I think he'd really enjoy that. But I also think that you need, and part of the reason why I'm interested in the Boston fit is because, you know, you've got Isaiah Thomas to do a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of offense initiation, scoring, and that would kind of set up a scenario where Jimmy would be maybe the second scoring option, kind of like DeRozan in Toronto, frankly, with Lowry, where, you know, he might actually get more points, but, you know, he doesn't have to do all of the heavy lifting that Lowry has to do. You know, if they could get along personality-wise, I think that's a pretty interesting 1-2 pairing. But if it's not in Boston, it's somewhere in Chicago, yeah, you're going to need, first of all, you need a point guard who can shoot threes, like, no matter what.
Mills, that would be good.
Yeah, yeah, he's a little undersized defensively. That could be a struggle, but, I mean, there's other guys out there. But, you know, ball handling and three-point shooting would be the most important. And then I think you'd want to have you'd want to make it a defense first team. You'd want to bring back some of that Thibodeau stuff in terms of, you know, just out grinding people because that's his personality. And they went so far away from that over the last couple of years that to completely reverse course and undo that with the same front office is like admitting your mistakes. And that's why it gets really hard to see, you know, are guys like Garpax going to do that? And does ownership even want them to do that? I mean, they got a big vote of confidence this week, despite, you know, a really tough season. Ownership seems happy with the direction. It's like makes no sense to me. And yeah, I think you can understand why some of these players would be frustrated, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it can't be, they can't be as lacking the adult in the room as the Sacramento Kings, though, who, I mean, I feel like they're, I'm at a really weird place with Boogie because before the new CBA, I always said, like, trade him because he's going to choose to leave. But now that that's not the reason for trading him, the calculus for me has shifted a little bit. It's like, do you trade him because this is just never, ever going to work? Or do you keep him because you just don't give up someone with that much talent? And that's, I feel a little bit like the whole Chicago thing, maybe a little bit even bigger of a tire fire.
Yeah, did you see his ejection the other night against Chicago?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so like, that was completely...
I'm surprised it's not a bigger deal, honestly.
Yeah, no, I thought it was completely inexcusable. Both those technical fouls were ridiculous. It cost him a suspension for this game against Boston, and you obviously need him against Boston. And it sets him up where potentially down the stretch here, he could miss, you know, five games because of technical foul suspensions. And that's just crazy, man. Like, there is no all-star ever should be in that situation, especially as a franchise player, a leader, that is just unacceptable. And he's way too deep into his career to be having this. I mean, if he was 21, I'd be able to, you know, maybe rationalize it slightly, but we're way past that. I thought the most telling part of watching that game, though, and watching him get ejected, was hearing the home broadcaster just completely lament that technical foul. He wasn't surprised. He wasn't angry at the ref. Sacramento's home broadcasting team was, okay, here we go again. At some point, he's going to have to stop doing that. And you don't hear that very often from home broadcasters around the league on League Pass, you know, that borderline criticism of their own players. And also just sort of the frustration with the antics. And you go from that to him not taking any questions after the fact. So, again, no accountability. It's troubling. And in the middle of all of this, Vlade Divac says, by the way, we're never going to trade him and we want to give him this, you know, super designated player extension, right? It's like, well, you know, where is that going to lead you? Again, I still feel his frustration you know, it's a terrible roster around him. You know, I think from positions 1 through 3, especially with the injuries that they've suffered, they probably have the weakest perimeter core in the entire league.
I was talking about this with someone the other day. Is Garrett Temple their second best player right now?
Yeah, and he's been injured too, right? Yeah, and he's actually played well. Like, I mean, he shouldn't be a punchline. That's the funny part is, like, it is kind of a joke, but he shouldn't be a punchline because he's actually been really good.
No, I agree. He's, you know, I actually was talking about, this was before Rudy Gay was injured. I was talking on a Kings podcast, and I said that he had more trade value for a good team than Rudy Gay because you couldn't see Rudy Gay playing 15 minutes on a really, really good team. But Garrett Temple has established that he could play 15 minutes on a really, really good team. He still probably shouldn't be starting for you, and he definitely shouldn't be your number two.
Yeah, and there's so many holes in that roster. And again, one of the key red flags for bad organizations, you know, do they develop their guys internally? And how many guys have just gone there to rot? And then how many guys have tried to escape as soon as possible? And then immediately they turn their careers around. I mean, I don't know if you saw that piece on Isaiah Thomas this week where he got a phone call when he got traded to the Celtics. And it was like, hey,
yeah,
good news.
Yeah, I saw that.
You know, good news. You're actually going to be playing for a real organization now. And, you know, Sacramento and Phoenix, they've got to read that. And their fans should just cringe because, I mean, that's not just like a passing comment. I mean, that's a legitimate sentiment, you know, that's around the league. And when you go back and look at Sacramento's track record with these young guys and the guys that they've drafted, not great.
Yeah. Yeah. Most Kings fans that I know at this point, and even people who cover the Kings that I know at this point, just say like, I'm a fan of the NBA. That's one type, you know, they're like, oh, I can't stand my team, but I still, you know, follow Sacramento because I just like the NBA and I like basketball. And then the other type is the one that is just, you know, if I get pushed any farther, I'm going to stop. But I think that that's just like covering this like, okay, you know, I know that this is going to keep happening, but, you know, whatever, that's just what it's going to be.
Do you play daily fantasy? If so, you should be playing on Draft. The data shows almost 90% of players lose on DraftKings, and on FanDuel, over 40% of the money goes to just 1% of the players. I'm not one of those 1%, so I prefer playing with Draft. Play for free, or better yet, play for money. And if you're not a pro, don't sweat it. You don't just get killed by that 1% who, you know, do play fantasy professionally. It's just you and anywhere from 6 to 10 other people, no pros, no robots, just the best daily fantasy app on the smartphone market. I just did a 10-person draft earlier, and I actually got Joel Embiid with my 7th pick. If you want to win, I suggest you probably should do the same. Trust the process. Also, trust me. Download Draft. Just search Draft in the App Store, and it will come up first, and after you've downloaded it, be sure to enter the promo code ABPN. That's ABPN as in Almighty Baller Podcast Network. When you do, you'll get an 100% bonus when you deposit. Deposit $20, you get another $20 free. Deposit $100, then you get $200 to play draft with, courtesy of ABPN, and we thank you for it. That promo code again is ABPN. Just search Draft in the App Store and get an 100% bonus on the Draft Daily Fantasy app.
Looking at the trade deadline, though, is there like any adult decisions to make? I mean, you talked a little bit about those guys who've just rotted on the bench. So who, if you were handed over the reins, first of all, I'm sorry that you have to deal with that. But if you were, you know, all of a sudden the GM, what type of trade deadline stuff would you be looking at doing? I mean, obviously you can't fix everything, but maybe you can start.
You mean for Sacramento?
Right.
Yeah, so the first thing I'd do is I'd build a time machine. I mean, definitely. And I would really strongly weigh my options when it comes to trading DeMarcus Cousins. And going out there and killing your own leverage by, you know, putting reports out there that you want to give him the max and saying that he's untouchable in trades is so dumb. I mean, it's just inexcusably dumb. They're doing it because they think they're protecting him, they're trying to keep him happy or whatever, but is that really in the organization's best interest? Do you see the best organizations and the best front offices doing those kinds of things? Do you ever negotiate a deal 9 months in advance in the media and have the starting point be the most possible money you can give to a guy? Like, give me a break. Like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. So I would use my time machine to undo that for sure. And then I would, you know, get serious about this, you know, trading Cousins thing. Now, the tricky part is, what do you really want from him? What can you expect to get back? And then do you trust their staff on hand to make the proper draft picks? You know, those are all really open questions. And I think the big takeaway should be Sacramento can't fix this at the deadline. I mean, they're going to have to take another hard look in the mirror. They're going to have to decide, you know, are they balancing Vivek's responsibilities properly? Does he have too big of a hand in things? Do they have the right, you know, draft gurus or whatever you want to call it, you know, talent evaluators in-house? Do they need to address that? And then who's going to make the call on these picks? And are they going to just draft another center from Europe because that's Vlade's fetish? You know, I mean, you can't put yourself in a situation where that's what you're doing year after year after year and burning all these potential picks. So, I don't know. There is not an easy solution at the trade deadline. I certainly would have tried to trade Rudy Gay before he got injured. The Garrett Temple thing is interesting. I'd almost be in favor of hanging on to him because if he can play that successfully in a crappy environment, he might actually be the kind of guy who can turn it around for you a little bit. I mean, you don't want to let
that turning around.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, being, you know, kind of a reimagining, if you will. So I don't think there's an easy solution, but you can look at all the steps that they've taken. They've all been missteps. Now they're boxed into a corner. And what can you do? I mean, if you're not going to trade Cousins, can you improve the trade deadline? No. I mean, you have nothing else that anybody wants.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe, like, if you were the Spurs or like, a well-run organization and you knew how to snipe good players in bad situations, basically guys who, like, maybe Ben McAdoo, basically guys like that who are rotting on other teams, maybe you could put stuff together. But, I mean, given the competence of the organization –
Well, that's the thing is, like, if you trade Ben McAdoo, you're selling low, right? I mean, basically, like, you've run his value into the ground and you're saying, well, we don't necessarily think he's going to be in the long-term plan, so we're going to try to get something from him. Now, that is a better plan than just letting a guy like Seth Curry walk out the door or Isaiah Thomas just walk out the door, right? I mean, there are bigger mistakes you could make than trying to sell low on Ben McAdoo. But is that going to get you any sort of a real asset if you trade him at this point after he's been basically invisible for the last 3 years? I say no.
I was saying, like, going and getting Ben McAdoo from a team like the Kings is the way that they could improve if they were not the Kings, right? I actually I was thinking while you were saying that, or while you were talking a little bit about the Kings organization, I think it was the last open court, or maybe it was the one before, you guys talked a little bit about the Suns front office and the Suns ownership and how they've avoided being labeled as in that top tier, like number 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 of most dysfunctional ownerships. I was thinking to myself that, yeah, I probably have bought into the product in terms of I like some of their young pieces too much that I've forgotten a little bit how, I mean, it's been 8 years since, maybe 10 years since the whole, since the last successful Suns team. And over that time, they've just done a lot of really bizarre things. So, just run with that. I mean, cause you had a lot of really good points about the Phoenix Suns and how their ownership is really screwed up and how their decision making has been really bad. But, maybe that's not the perception.
Yeah. So I wrote this actually a while ago, but if you go all the way back to like 2013 when they had to fill their GM job, you know, Charles Barkley came out and made a big joke about it. You know, he was saying, oh, the Suns are a tire fire. They should hire me. It was like the worst campaign of all time to try to become a GM. And, you know, everybody laughed at him and pointed and laughed at Barkley like, oh, you're a moron. Like, ha ha ha. Right. And then you look at the last 4 years in terms of what they've done. And like, I'm seriously wondering, like, could Barkley have done worse? Like, would he, if they had just given him the job in 2013, would he have done, you know, would he have made as many mistakes as they've made? And what's just impressive is that the spin that comes out of Phoenix, you see a lot of times on national sites, it'd be like, oh, their GM is just trying. He's up to stuff. You know, he's always like got his, you know, nose in whatever the action is. And it's like, well, sort of, but he's also just making every type of mistake you could possibly make. I mean, the best move he did for sure was acquiring Isaiah Thomas at the price he got him, but he immediately undid that by just gifting him to Boston, where, you know, he's really catapulted his career into all-star form. He accumulated too many players to the same position, as everybody knows, the point guards. He overpaid on a guy like Tyson Chandler when it was clear, you know, he was buying high right before the crash. Everybody kind of figured that he was the one guy who was willing to put the money up. He's chasing free agents like LaMarcus Aldridge when he doesn't have a great pitch to those guys. I mean, why should an A-list free agent want to go play in Phoenix? It never really made a lot of sense. They've spent an awful lot of draft picks on guys that really haven't worked out. I mean, most notably Alex Len, but there's been others. And, you know, even their current situation where you've got Eric Bledsoe playing the best basketball of his career, you've got a truly promising guy in Devin Booker who could wind up being the player that kind of saves everything. They're still terrible. You know, like if you have those two players and you've invested all this money in these veterans, you should be winning games, like more games than, you know, the Kings and the Lakers and like these, all these are horrible teams, but they're just atrocious. And again, it kind of goes back to, you know, commitment from ownership in terms of like, look how they handled the Jeff Hornacek thing. I mean, they just dragged their feet forever, hung him out to dry, probably because they didn't want to pay him to go away. He's getting towels thrown at him by his players. I mean, they've just had dysfunction on every level, and they really do, frankly, I think, benefit on the national scene from flying under the radar because you're always going to have craziness with the Kings. You're always going to have, at least recently, you know, pretty intense feelings about the Lakers. You know, you've got some of these other bad teams like the Sixers. I mean, they took all the headlines for like two straight years, gave all these rebuilding teams cover. And nobody really talks about Phoenix, but yeah, I think they're right there with anyone in terms of total dysfunction. And I'm not really sure what the reason is to believe, you know, and I don't know how many people are believing. Like they put them on TNT a couple of weeks ago. There was like 14 people in the building, you know, I mean, there's just like hundreds of empty seats all in the lower deck. I mean, nobody's there. I know they like Booker, but he's still, you know, ways away. So, you know, and another mistake I didn't even mention was the whole Brandon Knight thing. I mean, and that's another example of like situations. Is it a coincidence, do you think, that Brandon Knight's career just completely falls apart as soon as he gets to Phoenix? You know, I mean, he was almost an all-star, you know, snub type of guy when he was in Milwaukee. And then he gets traded and all of a sudden he just can't stay on the court. He can't stay healthy. He can't do anything right. He's got one of the worst real plus minuses in the league. Like, is that his fault or is it situational or is it a combination of the two? Those kinds of things tend to just keep happening in Phoenix. And I don't know. I kind of feel like I'm the only person bashing him. Like their front office seems like fairly media friendly and popular. And I don't understand why there's not more people kind of digging a little bit deeper and saying like, how many years are we going to give this guy here?
Yeah, I think last year they were really under the microscope when Sarver made all of those millennial comments about the Morris brothers. And there was like a point in time then when if you were talking about most dysfunctional ownerships and front offices, they were right there in the discussion. I think the reason why, I personally, and I'm not saying that I would put them, you know, way on the other side of the spectrum, but, I don't think that I was thinking about them, you know, in terms of being just like a tire fire, before listening to that. I think because I look at not, or I bought into the promise of the result rather than the actuality of the process. Because I think Marquese Chriss has so much upside and then Bender has a pretty high floor. You know, if Devin Booker is anywhere as good as a lot of NBA players think he's going to be and a lot of NBA fans, then that's significant. You know, Bledsoe is playing some of the best, you know, basketball of his career, and then they have professional scorer TJ Warren. So, I mean, in terms of like building a young core, I think they've done a decent job, but they just sort of, Who's the? Is it Detective Crusoe? Is the guy in the Pink Panther? Right?
I'm not sure.
I think it's Detective. They just sort of like Mr. Bean'd their way into that young core, I guess is what I mean.
Yeah, and I'm actually with you. Like, I think you can make cases for all those young guys that you made, like the under 23 guys. Like, they all have a shot, right? But it took them 4 years to get those guys, and we don't know if any of them are really going to completely pan. Like, we're pretty sure Booker will. But
he's probably still, even he is a little overhyped at this point, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, there's some flaws to his game, you know, and that's to be expected for a player his age. But, you know, you don't have, like, and if you want to do the comparison against Philadelphia, right? Like, I mean, it's mind-blowing when Embiid steps on the court and you're like, wow, okay, this is a real franchise player. You can kind of justify how long it took them to get it. If he winds up being the player who he's been for those, you know, 35 games he's played this year for the next 8 years, it was all worth it. All is forgiven. Phoenix doesn't have that guy, you know, and I'm not sure they're going to have that guy even in 2 years. And so what have they been doing for the last four? You know, it's just been cycling these players in and out. And, you know, the Markieff thing is a really interesting example. I interviewed him in L.A. After a game. He mysteriously didn't play and they said he was sick. And he actually did kind of turn out to be sick. But it was during that last season, right before he got traded to Washington, where you know, they've just been so much drama, and he had, you know, they've just been back and forth with the coaching and so on and so forth. And I was kind of like trying to hammer him a little bit with the questions just to kind of see, you know, how much responsibility was he going to take for it. And I was actually surprised. He took a lot of responsibility. Like he was saying, you know, he was saying all of the right things from a guy you might expect not to say the right things in those situations. And I think ultimately he realized that the problems were bigger than him. And my takeaway after talking to him was like, look, I'm not sure that Markieff is like part of the solution in Phoenix, but he's not the only bad guy. And that goes back to the Sarver comments that you mentioned. It goes back to their treatment of the coaching staff. It goes back to their lack of vision in terms of putting the roster together and how are the pieces going to fit. I mean, none of those things can be controlled by one power forward who, you know, top 15 guy at his position, maybe, you know, league average, maybe a little better on a good day. You know, at his spot, you know, not a superstar guy. And, you know, for the organization to almost like demonize one player or like have a lot of people rally around, you know, banging on that one guy, I thought it just really missed the bigger point.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I have two more teams I want to talk about, but I'm not sure how much time you have left. Do you think we have time to hit on two more?
Let's do it.
Okay, great. Then we're going to leave the Blazers for last, and we're going to go to Orlando. I don't even know what to say about Orlando, because, you know, I guess I appreciate that their GM took some responsibility and sort of said, you know, yeah, this hasn't gone as I thought, but he, I guess, was the last person on Earth to realize that things weren't going to go the way that he thought. Have they bought into the idea? Do you think that they've really committed to the idea and they're discussing, you know, okay, let's, you know, rebuild or let's get younger? And if they have, then like, how do you do that? Because I like Aaron Gordon. I'm not sure if he's the type of guy who you want to strip down your whole team and build around going forward. And I'm positive that Elfrid Payton is not the guy I want to do that with.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'm going to read you a few statements and then you tell me if they were, when I'm done, you tell me if they were made by the angriest Magic blogger on Earth or if they were made by the Magic's GM. Okay. So first, the first statement, and there's like eight of them and they're all by the same person. You can tell me at the end. Statement one, the Magic were supposed to be a defense first team, but so far this season, they've been quote unquote, extremely disappointing. The Magic have a bunch of perimeter players who all need to improve offensively in a number of key areas. The Magic have not played consistent basketball. They haven't had the necessary energy and effort, even though they're a pretty young team. The Magic want to have lineup diversity and versatility, but they just haven't been able to make that work. The Magic's younger players are feeling the effects of multiple coaching changes in recent years. The Magic need more shooting, shot making, and basketball IQ. And the Magic could also use additional experience and feel for the game. So was that made by like the angriest Magic blogger or the Magic's GM?
Are you trying to imply that the Magic GM is the tank commander on Twitter?
I'm not saying that. I think he seriously woke up from like a 3-year fever dream and was like, holy crap, my team is terrible. Because yeah. he said all of those things in an interview on the record with the Orlando Sentinel, where he's just ripping apart the team. And at some point you've got to be like, you're the one who built this. Like, you handcrafted this organization with a number of trades, with 4 years worth of lottery picks, with, you know, some real big swings. Like, you're mentioning the Elfrid Payton. Like, that was a big swing, you know, and that backfired. They've bled talent all over the league. Guys like Mo Harkless, Tobias Harris, Channing Frye. I mean, the Magic alumni team is definitely better than the Magic at this point. Victor Oladipo. How could I forget him? And so you're in the situation where it's like, I don't know who's done a worse job than him. And he basically is coming out and admitting it, and yet he hasn't been fired. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I have no clue what their upper management and their ownership is really thinking there. And I don't know how you save it. I definitely think that clearing the way, at least somewhat, for Gordon needs to happen, because I haven't seen a young talent as miscast as him in a long time. I mean, you have a guy who basically is a leaper, energy guy. You know, everything he's going to do should be coming in the paint, around the rim, putting pressure on defenses. You know, it's unfortunate he's not a good foul shooter, because he could just be one of those guys who just kamikazes at the rim, play after play after play, and gets a lot of points from the free throw line. And they basically turned him into a stand-up jump shooter, you know, and surprise, surprise, that's not working. So I don't know.
And having him handle the ball in pick and roll is just, it's literally the worst pick and roll in the league.
There you go. And so do we blame him, or do we blame the system? You know, it's like they're asking him to do things that just don't make a lot of sense. So I would be clearing out vets for sure at the trade deadline. I'd be punting the season. I mean, it's done. They're not going anywhere. They tried. And I would definitely be thinking long and hard about what's the post-Elfrid plan. And once you start to raise those kinds of questions, and those should all be public debates in Orlando, at that point, you know, it's probably time to start thinking about a management shift too. You know, I mean, if you have to like go back on, I mean, yeah, if you have to go back on these key decisions and they're all backfiring, then yeah, it's probably time to go a different direction. So we'll see if they're that self-aware, or if they're still kind of committed to their current delusion. But they should be sellers. They should be one of the biggest sellers at the trade deadline. And if they're not, there's a problem.
Yeah, and you know, even when you look at their young guys, that's the real dilemma for me isn't so much like, okay, they've gone in the wrong direction and that's fine, just like change course. You know, you could say a similar thing sort of about Chicago. We were talking about, okay, well, you could like tap the brakes and head in the Jimmy Butler direction, you know, get rid of Rondo, get rid of Wade. There are teams like that, but it's just like Aaron Gordon as the compelling piece to build around. I mean, even Bismack Biyombo, he's a good player. I really don't like that 5-4 combination next to each other. I think you should probably have a center who can, at least, you know, has gravity out to like 6 feet rather than 1 or 2 feet in, you know, like maybe Martin Gortat. If Aaron Gordon's going to work.
Agree. It's about as cramped as a 4-5 combination can get.
And that's terrible for Gordon if you want him to be the guy who you're saying you want him to be.
Yeah. I mean, I think that their only shot is to pray that Gordon somehow turns into this, like, do everything power forward, like Blake or, you know, some Draymond tendencies or some Julius Randle stuff offensively, where like his gifts just wind up overwhelming people. I don't know that that's going to happen, but like, that's almost, you know, their hope. I mean, one other option is sort of like what Denver's got going with Fried now. You know, a guy like Jokic can open it up for your power forward, you know, and some of the same things we've said about, you know, limitations for Gordon probably apply to Fried too, but he's maybe been a little bit more successful because you've got a playmaking center. So then the question becomes, like, do they have anybody currently on their roster who fits that mold? Like, that's kind of asking a lot out of Vucevic. I mean, certainly not Biyombo. But, you know, it could be a situation where to get the most out of Gordon, if he's really their best player, and it sure seems like he's like their highest ceiling guy that they've got because they've had so many bad moves in terms of draft picks and so forth. And you know, how much they gave up in terms of young players for Ibaka. They might actually have to find themselves in a situation where they trade all of their centers, you know, or two of them and just hold one as sort of like a backup. You know, I could see, you know, if they could get a better center, a better playmaker as a center, as a starter next to Gordon, maybe you keep Biombo as your closing, you know, defensive backup. But even then, we're still kind of grasping for straws. And one of my big, like, kind of high horse takeaways about things like this is that you can spend hours trying to figure out the logic of what teams are doing. It doesn't necessarily mean there's any logic behind it. You know, a lot of these guys are making very tough decisions, feeling pressure for their job, feeling pressure for the fan base, feeling the impatience, feeling the staleness that's, you know, might have come into their lives, you know, over the course of multiple losing seasons. That doesn't mean there's any logic behind what they're doing. You know, it just means that, you know, they're taking shots, and if the shots don't work out, you know, don't try to go back and put logic on top of them. You know, they were just, you know, choices that weren't necessarily made for the best reasons and didn't work out. And I think that's sort of where Orlando is, and they're not the only team in that situation. But I don't really see how this gets salvaged.
Did the Magic, they got Ibaka before they signed Biombo, right? Because I think, you know, it maybe makes some sense if Ibaka's a young 27 at center, and then Aaron Gordon's your four going forward. But, I mean, Elfrid Payton is one of my least favorite players in the league because I look at him and his skill set, and during the fall of the Rondo Empire in Boston, when, you know, I'm from Dallas, so I remember, like, thinking a lot about, like, whether or not we want to make a move for a guy like him, and watching the Celtics, even though he had those good numbers, they always had a better plus-minus without him out on the court. They always played better without him on the court. But he definitely had talents, and there was definitely some reason to have him on the court. It was just like, well, he can't shoot, so can you make this work? And you could start to toy with the idea that maybe it would work because he was such a good rebounder, such a good passer, you know, at least at some point was a really good defender. And it's like, you look at Elfrid Payton, and you have the same thing. Well, he can't shoot. Can you make a point guard in the modern NBA work who can't shoot? Maybe if they're good at all that other stuff, but Elfrid Payton is worse than Rondo at every other thing. And it's like, well, if Rondo doesn't work, then why would Payton work?
Well, I mean, that's one of those things where Oklahoma City took a big shot on Westbrook, you know, and there was all this talk around the draft of like, you know, does this guy, you know, have what it takes to play point guard. He's such a raw and unfinished athlete, et cetera, et cetera. And they swung so big on Westbrook and they hit such a big home run on Westbrook that I think that experience colored what Orlando did and what Hennigan did once he got to the Magic. You know, I think that was his thought is like, well, we're going to get this completely undervalued point guard who is going to be able to do certain things that everybody else is overlooking because he doesn't fit a certain mold, and they struck out, you know. And sometimes you hit home run, sometimes you strike out. I think they struck out.
Yeah. but shooters shoot, you know. So we were going to move on to the Blazers, but then I forgot that we touched on New York. Would you rather talk about Melo and Phil Jackson or Isaac Rop and the Blazers? You can choose.
Yeah, I mean, I think most people have probably talked about the Knicks into the ground. The Blazers situation is pretty interesting. You know, the other one where I think the GM has kind of flown under the radar a little bit in terms of criticism, especially locally. And I think that there's like a lot at play in terms of what happened with, you know, Isaac Rop. I happen to know him because I, you know, I'm from Portland originally. Like I've known him probably for 10 years or so. You know, I don't know like the specifics of that situation, but what I think, you know, people tend to maybe not realize is that, you know, these organizations are getting more and more proactive in how their product is presented to fans. You know, the websites, team websites have so much more content, so much richer content than they've ever had in the past. You look at, you know, some of them have their own traveling beat writers when some of the newspapers around locally don't even travel anymore. Some of them do their own in-house television production, you know, pre-game shows, post-game shows. The Blazers actually employ their own broadcasting crew. And so, you know, the possibility for some like Big Brother type scenario where, you know, somebody says the wrong thing and that gets them on the outside, you know, there's a lot of gray area for that kind of stuff to take place. And so I think there's people just need to really trust, you know, where are they getting their information from about the organization, especially locally. I mean, on the national level, it's a little bit different. You know, you have more columnists who are able to really speak freely and kind of have a pulpit and, you know, exchange information between, you know, multiple teams, multiple executives, agents, and so forth. But, you know, local media is very dependent upon, you know, the key figures in their organizations, especially in Portland. It's kind of like a one horse town. You know, everybody needs to go to the Blazers for news. All the advertisers locally, all the companies are advertisers for the team. You know, the team's, you know, involved with all sorts of local initiatives. I mean, it's a part of the community and it's kind of got financial ties everywhere. There is a lot of pressure for everybody to just kind of go on and be happy, even in a down year. And to me, from the outside, you know, a lot of the moves that Olshay made, especially the Evan Turner one, really blew up in his face pretty bad. And that's been a major reason why they've been disappointing this season. And I've also noticed that he's been awful quiet in terms of taking and accepting the blame for that, whereas in the past he's been pretty, you know, quick to take credit for things when they've gone well. And so I wonder, how does that sit with the players, first of all? And what does that mean for the coach? You know, I think that's a question. And then also, if he's feeling the pressure enough where, you know, these kind of back and forth with the media are getting to him, as allegedly happened, what does that mean about his own job security? And if you're the Blazers, when do you start to start going a different direction?
Well, I think I was thinking this during the whole finding out process of what happened with Rob. You have some experience with the Blazers and the way that they deal with media personnel, and you know, there is the whole Greg Oden thing, which you can choose to talk about or not talk about. I think it's interesting in relationship to this. But it's almost to me, like thinking about the history of the Blazers organization, not something that stems from Neil Olshay, although he could be like a conduit of this sort of media averse. I think Ivan Rapp like actually said that it's sort of like Trump. But that might be from all the way back with Walton. I mean,
yeah, right? For sure. I mean, it's been an organization that's had sort of, you know, so it's bouts with paranoia. I mean, a lot of that goes to the ownership. You know, Paul Allen used to be known as like kind of a Mark Cuban style, like impulsive owner. You know, he just fires somebody at the drop of a hat, and you know, he had his quote unquote hatchet man, this guy named Bert Cold, who was sort of his right hand man, and he'd walk through the office and, you know, people would like hide behind their desks and, you know, go lock themselves in the bathroom because they didn't want to get fired by him. I mean, these are sort of the stories that get told, right? And that has kind of changed, I think, in recent years. And my big thing with it is the personalities of the people in charge a lot of times dictate the media relations. You go back to the Kevin Pritchard era for the Blazers, you know, he's with the Pacers right now. That was one of the most hopeful and optimistic and I would say productive times for media members in Portland, in terms of accessibility, in terms of getting good stories, in terms of just, you know, being happy. It was badly needed sort of after the quote unquote Jailblazers era, where there was some really serious, you know, distrust between the local paper and the team. Then you go to Larry Miller. He kind of takes over and he's a former Jordan Brand executive, and now he's a current Jordan Brand executive. His style was much more corporate. He didn't care as much about the PR side of things. He was much more motivated by, you know, business interests of the organization and trying to expand the fan base and so forth. And so that kind of took on a different feel. And you get to Olshay, and the paranoia and some of the pettiness just of his personality has come out in how information gets distributed locally, you know, and that's kind of been an ongoing source of frustration for reporters there. You know, I think there is definitely some people who are afraid to criticize the team because they're worried about the repercussions. And, you know, Olshay's colleagues, you know, have said that about him in terms of his sensitivity to criticism. And then also, you know, other people, frankly, around the organization, you know, related to players and associated with players, you know, have kind of made the same point, too. It's just like that's his personality. Like he is not trying to get into a debate with anybody. Like it's his way or the highway. And as soon as he got there, he cleared out a whole bunch of other former Blazers executives and kind of consolidated power to kind of set things up so that it was his show. And I'm not sure that he saw these struggles coming. You know, I think he thought he had built this great roster that was going to be, you know, potentially in position to make a run of the Western Conference Finals. He had his two all-star guards in the backcourt and Lillard and McCollum, and everything was going to be hunky-dory. And that's not how the season played out. And, you know, if it continues to kind of, you know, drag along like it has been, again, it's going to go back to Paul Allen. Is he this new patient guy who's willing to give everybody another chance? Or is he out for blood like he was in previous times of his ownership tenure? And I don't know the answer to that. And nobody in Portland right now seems to know the answer to that either.
Well, so I guess my implication before was that it was like an ownership thing where, you know, your situation with Greg Oden and what happened with that, and then the previous outspokenness of Bill Walton, you know, and I'm not even sure if Paul Allen was the owner of the team then. Maybe my timeline is messed up. I was sort of trying to imply that maybe it was stemming from ownership, but from what you just said, you think it's a tenor that's set by each incoming GM, and they can sort of choose to be one way or have one relationship or the other as far as the media, and it's not something that's endemic of the Trailblazers.
Yeah, it's tricky because, you know, Paul's interest in the team kind of comes and goes. Like, he owns the Seahawks, too. The Seahawks have been really good. You know, they've won on a level the Blazers haven't. And so he's also based in Seattle. So how many games he even shows up to over the course of a given season will fluctuate. You know, there's some seasons where he's at every single home game, never misses a game. And there's some seasons where that's not the case. You know, some seasons where he was at Las Vegas Summer League practice, if you can believe that. You know, I mean, he's that interested in his product, even as this, you know, billionaire former Microsoft executive who's got yachts all over the world and can, you know, go on these crazy African safaris and so forth. I mean, he could do whatever he wants. And, you know, he was excited enough to go see, you know, Lillard's like Summer League practice. So his interest level and his relationship with the team does kind of fluctuate. So the constants are the guys who are there every single day in Portland. And those are the people who are really having and creating the environment for the media. And I think that's where their personalities get involved, like I mentioned earlier. Another thing, too, is like even on a good year, Paul Allen would meet with local media members at most twice. You know, there'd be like a preseason at a practice. He would take questions in a scrum. And then usually towards the end of the year, he would do like a sit down in one of the locker rooms where he would just take questions for like 15, 20 minutes. And that's it. So, you're trying to read him and figure out exactly where he's at is much more difficult for the media. And so a lot of whatever his feelings might be are going to have to be filtered through the executives who he's communicating with, if that makes sense.
All right. Awesome. Well, hey, thanks for spending all this time with me. If you want to have a parting shot at either Phil Jackson or Melo, then you're welcome to have it. But otherwise, I can lead you out. And you know, I'm happy either way. I think this was great. I think if we send this out to some of these organizations, they can listen and take some pointers.
Oh boy, well, we've got management 101 for them. That's good. No, I think the last thing, just don't tweet. You know, Phil Jackson. Like, what was that tweet? I mean, what did you think of that tweet?
The Phil Jackson tweet?
Yeah.
I think it might be just because Trump is on the mind, I guess. And that's a lot of the reason why I think that Rob got those comparisons too. You know, whether or not they work, and maybe they do. I think they probably do. But that's what I was thinking. I was like, what other president would be tweeting like this? And what other owner would do that? You know, like, what are you doing? You know, isn't that odd? Isn't it? I might be wrong, but like, I feel like the fact that Phil Jackson is choosing to make statements like that, that he knows that everyone's going to talk about through the medium of Twitter, is just like a really odd thing for the president of a organization to do.
Yeah, and it also just kind of goes back to, like, you know, if you're a coach, you can kind of justify the needling. But if you're a front office executive whose team is struggling, you know, you've got to be part of the solution. I don't know how that fixes anything. You know, are you really going to motivate Carmelo Anthony to be this winning basketball player in the middle of the season that's basically already lost? Like, what is the point of that tweet? Are you trying to push him off the cliff so he demands a trade? Didn't seem like
he's trying to motivate Melo to be a good basketball player on a different team.
Yeah, I know. And like, how is that going to work? Just get on the phone and trade him, you know, come up with a good package that he can agree to. Like, I don't know. It just doesn't seem like that should be part of his job at all. But, you know, Phil is going to Phil, you know, just like Steph's going to Steph, Phil's going to Phil. And, you know, I'm not surprised the Knicks are where they are. Anybody who got their hopes super high up about the Knicks earlier this season, I kind of feel sorry for. I mean, that's a tough one to take, but you know, they're a victim of their own past mistakes. They continue to make the same ones over and over, and they get the same results, and no one should really be that surprised by it.
Yeah, and I mean, this is my personal take, but I think people read a little too much into the tea leaves with all of Phil Jackson's career. I mean, I think, like, this idea that he went into LA and made all the pieces fit by pitting Kobe against Michael Jordan, but also pitting Kobe against Shaq, and that's how the dynasty was formed. I think maybe it was the fact that they were one of the best, if not the best, 1-2 combo ever assembled. That maybe is the reason for the championships. and if anything, it's kind of sad that it had to end as early as it did. But I think people look at that and it's like, well, Phil Jackson must have had a plan. He must have been Zen. But that's not how I interpret it. We should probably close this podcast up. For all the listeners out there, I really appreciate you listening. But you know, you would have nothing to listen to if my guest Ben Golliver today hadn't joined me. So, Ben, I've talked a little bit about your podcast, Open Court. And about your writing over at SI. Do you want to shout anything else you've been working on as far as written content or, you know, Twitter handle, stuff like that before we leave?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Ben Golliver, BENGOLLIVER. And check us out on SI.com/NBA.
All right, awesome. Well, hey, again, I appreciate it. And to all you GMs, I think that we're the foremost experts on how you should be doing your job, so you don't need to worry about it. Just listen, and maybe you can be the adult in the room, too. So I'll talk to you later, Ben.
All right, man. Take care.